Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Nancy Pagg. Nancy Pagg was born and raised on Fidalgo Island in Anacortes, Washington. Before earning her master's degrees in literature and creative writing at the University of New Hampshire and a PhD in interdisciplinary studies at the University of British Columbia, she worked in the scientific publications unit of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle. She teaches English and Canadian studies at Western Washington University and lives in Bellingham. Her new book, entitled No Sweeter Fat, won the Autumn House Poetry Prize and was published in 2007. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Hi, Jen. I'm great. Thanks.
We're happy that you're here. And we also want to mention that Michael Sims published your book, and we're grateful to Autumn House for bringing you here. So
I am, too. Yeah. It's a beautiful book, and I'm really happy that it got picked up by Autumn House.
So you're going to read from the new book.
I am. I'm going to start with a poem from the center of the book called Among the Vegetarians, with apologies to Walt Whitman. Sometimes I would like to turn and live among the vegetarians. They are so placid and so self-contained. They understand the eggplant's secret firmness, the tabula rasa the bean curd is. I contemplate them long and long. Death does not linger on their breath. The darker crevices of their cutting boards are safe. They exist without asking another animal to kneel and spill itself. The gentle eyes of the vegetarian flash liquid revelations to me, and I accept them. Theirs is an appetite to know and be filled with the scallop, the coho, the razor clam's dignity apart. My hunger takes the cream-white flesh of the halibut, the migrating eye of the halibut, the scythe-mouthed strike of the halibut, the graveled bed of the halibut, the cold gray sea of the halibut, in every bite. It is incised, protean, unassuaged by toast. My hunger wants more than the halibut and finds it in the halibut. Believe me, sometimes I think if you were as much of this world as the halibut, I would have to eat you, too. I like to read that poem first at a reading, kind of to say, watch out! I'm coming to get you. I'm coming to get you with this reading. Because I think one of the things that links the poems together in this book is a kind of hunger for so many different things. Hunger for food and hunger for love and hunger for a voice and to be heard and a hunger for there to be kindness in the world. A lot of the poems, too, are linked by this awareness of coming after Walt Whitman and being a tremendous lover of Walt Whitman's work. So that poem is kind of a riff on his really long poem, Song of Myself, where he talks of how much he admires the animals. And the book begins with an epigram that quotes that same poem. Walt Whitman in Song of Myself writes, I have pried through the strata and analyzed to a hair and counseled with doctors and calculated close and found no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones. So that's where the title of the book comes from. The second poem I'll read is the first poem from the book, and it's called Blackberries. I would like to write you a poem about fat ladies, but you prefer to read of blackberries. There are 864 poems about blackberries published in English. Where is the harm in another? So let's say that the wildest fat ladies grow on low runners that snake unplanted along the driest hillsides of coastal British Columbia. The tight knot of their fruit is smaller than all others and shaped like the bud of your own coldest nipple. I heard a 16th century Italian printer despaired the destruction of cuttlefish and began making his books with the juice of fat ladies. A transplanted Himalayan variety of fat lady ripens in cow pastures late in the autumn. It hangs in black clumps among serrated yellow leaves, tasting like barbed wire, hatred, and the mineral note of self-abnegation. Your tongue thrills to meet such darkness. Royalty used to reserve the color of fat ladies just for itself, but now the CEOs all favor a striking red tie. The American president follows suit. Fat ladies travel many miles in the gut of a bear to colonize the bright waste of clear cuts. I would like to read the diaries kept on one of these passages. Have you ever noticed that the biggest fat ladies are just beyond your reach? Fat ladies do not taste like salmon berries. Salmon berries do not taste of salmon. Fat ladies taste good when you are standing near the Nooksack River, watching the salmon, or watching the places you wish there were salmon. Fat ladies permanently stain everything except your tongue. An overripe fat lady drops in your palm with the slightest touch. If you try to blow off the roadside dust, you will break its tender skin and miss the holy communion of eating the roadside dust. Oh, that first day you notice the fat ladies have withered and dried on their vines, a regret more tart than the small unripe segments of the first fat lady you ate that summer. Again and again the fat ladies push into every unclaimed corner of the neighborhoods, reminding the soft palates of children there really are things in this world so sweet and so free. There are so many fat ladies. Where is the harm in sprinkling one with sugar to watch the materialization of Homer's wine-dark sea? That poem I put first as a kind of an invocation or a calling out to the reader in a way to say that it feels really important to me to write about something that for me in my own life has been taboo to write about or even to think about too much, which was the topic of fat and weight and body consciousness, obesity. And there really are so many poems. Everyone's got a poem about blackberries. So I thought, how can I slip it in? How can I say writing about this topic could be literary as well? I have a series of poems within the first section that have the phrase fat lady in the title, and they're kind of persona poems. The fat lady does this, the fat lady does that, and of course they're all really me. I discovered after I wrote them, but shall I read one of those?
Sure.
Sure, okay. This one is called Fat Lady Reads. A fat lady reads a book. She reads a book all day, and all day she is not a fat lady, unless she reads a diet book or Wally Lamb's She's Come Undone. And there's a good chance she reads one of those. A fat lady reads a book and enters a world where there really are no fat people of consequence, except old Mrs. Manson Mingott in Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, whose, quote, immense accretion of flesh descended on her in middle age like a flood of lava on a doomed city, unquote. And except the rude person, repeatedly referred to as the fat man, corpulence meant to represent everything unaware of its own privilege, in Bharati Mukherjee's A Wife's Story. Wealthy matchmaking fat ladies and chubby men who use more than their half of an armrest at the theater are just useful minor characters. The fat lady reads and identifies with the heroine or hero, and we all know who they are. Their pants fit. The fat lady understands you cannot expect regular people to identify with a tubby Ishmael or believe he could carry that belly all the way up the Pequod's spars. Or relate with the poet Amy Lowell, who the Heath Anthology of American Literature says was an unattractive, overweight woman an old maid, a lesbian, soundly rejected by readers and reviewed as a failure because she was, quote, cut off from the prime biological experiences of life by her tragic physical predicament, unquote. A fat lady writes a book. She writes a book all year, and all year she's fat, but never writes about that. She wants to be a serious writer. What a tragic literary predicament.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Nancy Pagg. She's reading from her new book, No Sweeter Fat, winner of the 2006 Autumn House Poetry Prize. I just went back in time for a minute there. But I want to ask about the fat lady poems, but first about Amy Lowell. That's so unbearable what was written about her.
I teach Amy Lowell when I teach Introduction to American Literature, and I always kind of gulp and blush when I read that anthology isn't saying that about her. It's saying that's what reviewers in her time said about her. But the idea that being a large, it even says that she must have weighed about 200 pounds and how outrageous it would be to be that way. But I think there's a connection made between Amy Lowell's having confidence to publish her own work and to participate in the imagism movement, and the way that Ezra Pound turned on her and referred to that as imagism. There was something about her bigness that seemed so appropriate, so inappropriate for a woman in her time, and the way that she was attacked for that size seems – it's something I still feel today. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, talk about your decision to write the fat lady poems and how you talked about having that be regarded as a serious poetry and how you – we're sneaking that in with the Blackberry poems.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's still a feeling of censorship there.
Mm-hmm. I think it may have been self-censorship more than anything else at the time. I had a poetry manuscript that I had been shopping around. These days you really have to enter competitions to get your work read, and so that feels so harsh to send off the check for $20 to have someone read your work and then have it come right back. And I guess I'd been sending a manuscript out for a year and a half or 2 years. And after it had been rejected 50 times or so, I thought, all right, why don't you just pretend like you did have a first book published? What would your second book be about? You know, and I found that so freeing to think a blank slate. You don't have to keep, you know, there's no sense of continuity. Your style can change. Your subject matter could change. What would you do? And I asked myself, well, what are you most afraid to do? What is it that you aren't allowing yourself to dig into because it seems too frightening? And I think that's an important thing for writers to do, because there's probably some real power there to what you would have to say, and that it would probably be a good thing for you just as a human being to go there. So kind of made a little deal with myself that I would write one poem about being a fat woman. And that poem ended up being a kind of a list of all the things, all these different tangents about that experience that I would like to write about. And then from that list, I ended up writing maybe 25 poems or so, and made them into a chapbook manuscript, sent it off. And that was immediately a finalist in a chapbook competition. So that was very encouraging to me to keep sending work out, to keep going. I always would have kept going and kept writing no matter what, but to keep sending it off to publishers and saying, keep trying to see if anyone else would care and want to read this. So I took those poems and merged them with what I felt was the best work of the previous manuscript, and sent that off. And it was immediately a finalist for 4 or 5 competitions, and selected by Tim Siebels to win the Autumn House Press book prize. And I was also very surprised. It taught me something that a man chose this book that is so focused on a woman and her concerns about her body. And I think if I would have known who the judge was for the competition, at that point I was starting to think you need to be more selective and send to competitions where women are going to be the judges, because maybe men don't want to hear this. And Mike Sims at Autumn House has been so supportive of what I'm saying and how I'm saying it. And I found that maybe I was kind of quick to judge who the audience might be for this material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really never know, you know, even though there is great evidence out there for, mm-hmm. You know, there's, I don't think it's all self-censorship that's happening. I mean, it's great mm-hmm. evidence out there for discrimination against women and fat women.
Yes.
Et cetera.
But there are allies, too.
There are allies.
Yes.
That's good. How about some more poems?
Sure. I started with the fat woman poems because they were a way to sort of write in third person about she, which I'd never done. All my poetry before had been in the first person and was always lyrical. And so I wrote the fat woman poems with the she. But then I switched back into that voice of me and writing from my own experience. So I'll read one of those poems. This one is called GBS. If you think I meant the global positioning system, you have wandered into the wrong poem and got lost in a dark wood with wolves and witches and hungry children who satisfy themselves by eating candy, then die in an old lady's oven. This is the forest of Snow White and Rose Red, the good daughters who let the bear in from the storm and brush the snow from his fur and stroke his head so prettily he growls by the fire in pleasure. This is the forest where one good turn causes the girls to meet with the bear under different circumstances and not get eaten. Instead, a kindly woodsman uses his sharp axe to vivisect that bear and reveal a golden-haired prince who steps out to marry the prettiest girl. Or sometimes, of its own accord, the bear's skin falls away in great folds arranged at the prince's feet like a warm brown lake. I personally always imagined a zipper the prince could employ from inside that giant body. I am thinking of that now, as I stand beside my sister, helping her remove her nightgown so she can take her first shower after gastric bypass surgery. I think about the woodcutter's axe when I see for the first time the ragged line of incision beneath a trail of surgical staples running from her sternum and into her pubis's forest. The surgeon told us her red and yellow organs were unusually petite, and she can expect to become no more than a size 6. She weighs 360 pounds, has a stomach the size of a walnut now, and is willing to die for someone lovely and golden to step out. I lay the nightgown on her bed, and we pad slowly to the bathroom. Two good bears, lost in the woods, on different paths now. Some of the poems are more of a celebration. They're not all downers, necessarily, talking about this topic. And the next poem that I'll read is more about that wishing that someone had come to terms with the beauty of their body the way it is sooner in life. This poem is called Falling. It fell in her 30s. Her fat fell in her 30s, but didn't go away, not really, just shifted subtly one day, redistributed itself without quake, without ash, just repositioned itself downstream, carried below her bones and ridges, lower down, underneath the places it had sat atop before. Her fat fell one summer afternoon in her 30s as she walked to the mailbox in shorts and observed her thighs now had a rhythm all their own, a sort of seismic backbeat to her purposeful stride, and gelatinous, too. Her fat fell along the gravel driveway and caused her to look in the mirror upon returning to the house and make the abrupt acquaintance of her new jowls, the flap beneath each arm. It seemed as if her fat continued falling over the edge of her bed as she sat there and dressed each morning all that long week. When her fat settled, she had time to survey the erosion and damned if she didn't miss the former full peaks of her breasts so fervently hidden by sweatshirts. She grew nostalgic for that solid ledge of belly. The supple timbers of her forearms were even the broad landscape that her own face had been. Her fat fell in her 30s, causing her to become sentimental and notice for the first time ever that it had all been so beautiful in the first place. I thought maybe we would switch over and look at some of the other poems, too, that were in the manuscript that Autumn House Press chose. I think of myself really as a person who writes about place, our place in the world. That poem that I just read about falling is very much looking at a person's body as a sort of territory or terrain. My sense of beauty and aesthetics is really grounded in the place that I grew up, which is just so beautiful. I feel really lucky to have grown up there. So I'll read a couple poems that are grounded in that love. The first one is called Spring Salmon at Night. I thought the west wind called me from bed, the night the river ran so hard. I followed it over the moonlit lawn, across the road and into the woods, climbing fallen cedars and moving beyond the skunk cabbages. I followed the west wind to the riverbed and plunged my legs in dark water that sucked and swirled behind my knees and tried to pull me beyond the bank. And the wind stopped, and I forgot why I came out in the night. And I clenched the underwater moss with my toes and was lost until the spring salmon came, their torpedo-shaped bodies knowing me as another follower of currents. In the cold gray river, the spring salmon found and circled me, their forms almost warm, as they touched the backs of my legs, guiding me back through the forest, across suburban lawns, and down my own hallway from bedroom to kitchen, until I found myself standing at the cat food cupboard and recognized each cat circling my legs and my own gullibility or desire to be led in the direction of someone else's hunger. That poem, I don't expect a reader to get the connotation that I had in mind at all, but I wrote that poem in the spring when America was rushing into war with Iraq, and I was really conscious of there being this sense of flow in the media of here's where we're going, here's where we're going, here's where we're rushing, and the allusion to a torpedo-shaped body was this sense of us as a nation running somewhere. Mm-hmm.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Nancy Pagg, reading from her new book, No Sweeter Fat, winner of the Autumn House Poetry Prize. I want to ask you about the range of poems in your book, because mm-hmm. there is quite a range. You know, you have the fat woman poems, and you have these really interesting poems about salmon and halibut and poems of place. Mm-hmm. And it seems like part of what joins them is a sense of territory, you know, body is territory, a sense of hunger, which you talked about. But it's kind of amazing to have, you know, these. So there's a lot of humor in the book, too.
There is a lot of humor in the book. I'm a funny girl.
But can you talk about that range and how you handle having these very, very serious poems in the book with this great humor? How do you negotiate that large range?
I think that comes a lot from my family. I grew up in a very funny family, a humorous family, but a family of Northern Europeans who don't talk a lot about things that maybe can be hard to talk about. And so we communicate a lot through gestures, which includes feeding each other, right, food, and a father who will check the pressure on my tires on my car instead of saying I love you. I mean, you know, we do things for each other to show each other how we feel, and we use humor a lot to diffuse and to communicate. And so a lot of my humor is in the book comes through as, I think, a kind of wit, which I hope never I don't think I'm this kind of person who uses humor in a cynical way, in a way to demean or to poke at, but a way to say, okay, this is kind of hard to talk about, but let's just sidle up to this sideways and we can giggle along the way and then have kind of a zing at the end by the poem saying, but I mean this, but I'm serious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have time for a few more.
Okay, I'd like to read a poem that's dedicated to my friend Gabby Helms. She passed away from breast cancer a few years ago, and I wrote this poem when she had been dead for a few months. And this one, too, makes a reference to Walt Whitman, his famous line about after his death, look for me under your boot soles, look for me under the leaves of grass. This poem is called Unaccountable. I understand I should not write of beauty these days for all the obvious reasons, and my own friend dead these 5 months now, and I'm not over, not nearly over, any of it. But I can't help it, am powerless to stop noticing the bug on my bathroom wall is a miniature dragonfly. Iridescent blue counties occupying the paper map of each wing. Driving to the park and ride, I took a deep breath of May morning and smelled summer coming and joy and the remains of Walt Whitman in the scent of fresh laid asphalt. And today I am not afraid of death because everything in this world is beauty, even the coal black asphalt. Even the crows that dive and scream at the confused young hawk soaring too near their nest at the edge of the trailer park. Yes, the trailer park, too. Its magenta rhododendrons more brilliant than aluminum. Its TV antennas writing the Chinese character for happiness 15 times against the sky. And me, as I stood unaccountably still, in the graveled park-and-ride lot, head back, watching a gull breaststroke the universe, watching the chalky stream it shat, transform into gorgeous sunlit spangles, and did not even think of moving.
That's the poetry of Nancy Pagg and her book No Sweeter Fat. Thank you so much for being here.
It was my pleasure. I'm happy to be here in Pittsburgh with you, Jen.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Sound engineers are Amy Sutton and Ziggy Edwards. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.